Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
Well, it's rare to get a day off and rare that they both get it off at the same time, but frankly, they were out of ideas and stories to tell. So Marie and Dunnigan are away today and I'm joined by Damien O'Mara. It's Monday, the 25th of May, and this is Game On.
And as always, a busy programme to come on the way as golf continues to show us the future of live sports. Without fans, we're going to be joined from Florida by the reigning Open champion, Shane Lowry.
It was almost like I couldn't wait to get finished just to take it all in and to enjoy it all because... Like I didn't know that I'd ever achieve something like this, and to be able to do it, it's just incredible.
Plus, we have Gian Balagai on the league in return, and trainer Jerry Lyons on the upcoming spotlight on Irish horse racing.
And you can text the program as always 51552. You can tweet at Game On 2FM. Ruby, how are you?
I'm very good, Damien. Yourself?
Not a bother now. I'm always kind of reluctant to start talking about how beautiful a day it is here because you could have someone somewhere listening and it's been lashing rain or snowing, but it's been one of those glorious days in Dublin that you'd almost be reluctant to come into work if we didn't do a job as enjoyable as this job.
Well, I have come into my own office at home because I am still in the confines of County Kildare, and whilst it was a beautiful day, it does look a bit chilly outside now, and thankfully... I'm not a Leinster season ticket holder. Are you, Damien?
No, I'm not. No, sure. Come here. Why would I pay for something that I can try and blag my way into with a press card? So it's a strange one today. Leinster, I think, probably, is it fair to say, the first, I was going to call them a sports franchise, or certainly a sports team, to come out the blocks and have effectively cancelled their season tickets for next year. Fans who are current season ticket holders will have the opportunity to take part in what they call an official membership, from which I presume they will sell tickets when the RDS gets up and running. But we're facing into this new reality where there's not a hope that the RDS next year, Ruby, is going to have 18,300 people in attendance for too many games unless there's a vaccine or the landscape of the world changes very, very quickly. So you'd imagine that they are just one of a number of teams that are going to end up doing something like this.
Yeah, but even if you think about social distancing in a stadium, all right, so there's nobody in the seat beside you, but there can be nobody in the seat in front of you or behind you either, somewhere like the RDS, because that's also within the confines. So what does a capacity in the RDS become if people abide by social distancing rules? 2,500, 3,000 maybe? Who knows? What are the financial implications going to be?
But you see, that's the interesting aspect of all this, that, okay, there's this perception that does the rounds and people will talk about affluent Dublin Four and Leinster Rugby and everything else. But, you know, Leinster have done a great job of promoting themselves as the 12th county army over recent years. And a lot of the money that, okay, the glamour names might be paid central contracts from the IRFU, but how much of the money that comes in from that 12,800 strong season ticket group, which is just even to have the security of knowing that money is there at the start of the year, that you can plan for some level of a budget, it's a massive amount of money to lose out on.
Oh, huge. And that's going to be the economics for every sport going forward. Like, I mean, horse racing is set to return on the 8th of June. How long will that be sustainable behind closed doors? The revenue from gate receipts, even though people maintain media rights, the money there is what probably maybe props a lot of them up. But they're also going to be reduced as well. So it's going to be some serious financial thinking going to have to be done. And Leinster have obviously somehow formulated a budget that can allow them to do what they're doing, because to cut off those 12,500 season tickets, that revenue stream, so early, that's a massive call.
Let's hear from within the province itself. Their chief executive, Mick Dawson, has been chatting to Leinster Rugby Television.
Yeah, I think what we want to do in Leinster, and I'm sure everywhere, is to make sure that everybody is treated as fairly as possible. And if you put money up for any of those big games towards the end of the season, or indeed some of the home matches in the Celt in the Pro 14, that your money will be refunded automatically, and that any monies owed to people for the non-performance of the last couple of matches in the season will be credited on their account for going forward, hopefully in season 21-22. Well, I think it's very important that we all have a target, and I think everybody who's involved in the Pro 14, all the other territories as well, all agreed that we'd like to start on the 22nd of August. So at least now Leo and the players have a target to aim for. I mean, I hasten to add that this target we have set is always subject to government approval. And I know that the IRFU are working very closely with the government on return to train and return to play protocols. And we're also working with the government on how stadia would work with no spectators, with limited spectators. So hopefully we can gradually get back to where we were one day. But we also need the other countries to work with their governments to make sure that everybody's on the same page.
Like, Ruby, there's a big issue in that as well, is that how different life is now going to be, whether you're a Leinster player playing in the RDS or presumably, you know, Munster, Connacht, Ulster, likewise, compared to, say, if you go to play a Champions Cup game against Northampton or something and guidelines are different in different places. Like, I know this is probably something you've talked about before, but how important is the Cheltenham roar? How important is the crowd cheering you on as you would have come into the closing stages of a race? Or how important realistically is that packed RDS to the Leinster players?
I don't know is the honest answer. I think I can only speak from the jockey's point of view, and you rode so often in empty stadia that almost the full stadium was a novelty. And yeah, you loved the intensity of it as you left the parade ring in Cheltenham and cantered to the start. But when you got away from the crowd at the start, they didn't come back into your head. I never had the privilege of playing at a Pat Crow Park or a Aviva Stadium or anything like that, so I don't really know what the crowd adds to a game. But I do wonder, Damien, this is going to get down to finances and costs and money. I wonder, will Leinster play in Donnybrook rather than the RDS, because it'll be cheaper to open? I wonder, will GAA matches not be played in Crow Park at all? Will they be played in O'Toole Park or even Parnell Park? You just wonder, will these big games be played in much, just on pitches? And just soccer matches be played in Abbottstown?
But just even, like, you've raised a very interesting point on Donnybrook. When you look at, like, the women's Six Nations matches in recent years, and one team lines out at the Bective end and the other team lines out at the Wesley end. So you've got two dressing rooms which are further than the distance of a pitch apart, whereas, you know, the RDS, they come down the same corridor together, Thomond Park, likewise. That, yeah, all of these could make health sense as much as financial sense.
Yeah, but I think finances, I think the longer the lockdown goes on and the slower we're starting to come out of it, the more people are beginning to look at the finances of all these things. And I don't think opening big stadiums is going to be anyway financially viable if there's no crowd. And I think a lot of matches will be played on just pitches.
Yeah, and just before we move on, does another big issue then arise from, not necessarily how dedicated elite sports people are, because we know they are, but, you know, you're into now, like, seismic and potentially long-term pay reductions or complete restructuring if, you know, 12,800 season tickets aren't there to bankroll Leinster. It'd be interesting to know the extent to which, that, you know, how big a percentage of their revenue stream is that for the year, one would wonder, but it has to be healthy enough.
Yeah, then you wonder about the implications on their academy and their systems further down. If they're going to have to keep financing the top, is the bottom going to suffer in sports like that? And, you know, that will go through golf as well. Will they be able to keep financing each and every tour? Or will it just be the top tours that survive? You know, you saw that today in England where Gary Neville was on about it yesterday, about the lower division teams and the financial bailout they're going to need. The Premier League might survive, but will the lower league survive? It's going to be very interesting how it all plays out.
Yeah, that's a big thing to talk to Guillaume Balaguer about later on, about La Liga. Now, you mentioned various GAA club grounds. Are you increasingly getting a bee in your bonnet around this debate around should the GAA open the gates of every local ground around the country back open to the masses?
Well, I'm just tired of the debate, to tell you the truth, Damien. It seems to be rumbling on and going nowhere. I mean, John Horan was pretty emphatic in what he said, and yet since then people have come out one after the other saying, oh, come on, you have to open up, you have to move it forward. I don't know. I think for everybody, we all need light at the end of the tunnel and we all need a bit of hope. And I think by being so negative, I suppose that probably has turned me off the debate, to tell you the truth. And there was contrasting arguments this weekend. Pat Spillane made his point, Dick Clerkin made great ones in the paper today, and Malachy Clerkin about people training on pitch or in parks just down the road from him. Everybody has a view and everybody has an angle, but I can't see why they can't open GAA pitches and let people be responsible for themselves and conduct themselves in a way that is permittable.
Yeah,
but
you look at it, like, we went down for a walk along Dollymount Strand last week, kind of an impromptu thing, and then 15, 20 minutes later, you know, the place is absolutely thronged. So who, you know, who ultimately has the responsibility to say, right, lads, such and such a team can land in on the pitches tonight and do a little bit of work somewhere here along the way, that ultimately, you know, you get young lads into a group, or you get, you know, a group of girls who are involved in a team, it's going to be very, very hard for them to self-police, you know, being the crack killers that are going to decide here only a certain amount of us can play here.
That's true, but I think that's going to be the new normal. And look, I suppose Dick Clarkin was right. Till kids go back into shops buying ice creams, how can you expect them to go back onto GAA pitches? I thought that was a very good way of looking at it. But like, I drove across the Curragh yesterday, Damien, and it was like the Curragh 25 years ago. There was cars parked everywhere, people out walking, there was a couple of groups playing football, three and four people kicking the ball around. I mean, they can do it on the Curragh. Why couldn't they have done it in Moorfield, just behind the railway station?
The flip side to that then is, like, as part of this argument is that there are people who need somewhere to exercise, and, you know, the potential to, say, open a walking track or allow people to do circles of the pitch. Like, is it disingenuous to suggest that if you're that stuck for somewhere to go out and exercise, I'd be interested to see where it is you're living, because surely there's some amenity somewhere close by, even if it's only to wander around your estate. You can't be that stuck for somewhere to get out and do a little bit of exercise that you emphatically need a GAA pitch.
No, but I think a lot of GAA grounds are set up for it, and I think when you look at what's happening on the roads at the moment and the amount of traffic starting to come back on them, yet the amount of people walking and running on roads, I could see the definite argument for opening GAA pitches to allow people exercise there and use the running tracks around the outsides of them. And look, the GAA is part of the community, and here we are debating it again, even though I'm tired of debating it. I think they should be open, and the GAA should be helping the community.
But then the flip side of that is, okay, you know, the GAA does hold this particularly unique place within the Irish psyche and the communities around the country, but where's the same arguments being made, say, about basketball clubs that have made the decision to shut up their facilities, rugby clubs that have made the decision to shut up their facilities? That, is it just a case that the GAA is so an inherent part of what it is Irish sport is about that the conversation is different around them than it might be around others?
I think basketball is indoor, so I think there's a problem with that. And we are in the month of May, almost in June, so the rugby season is essentially over for amateur players. So it is GAA time. Maybe GAA and maybe soccer clubs should be, people should be asking the question to them as well. But basketball's inside. That's a different ball game, and it's not rugby time of year.
Okay, Grant. That puts me back in my box. Just, we're going to be joined by Shane Lowry in a couple of minutes' time. Did you watch any of the Tiger, Manning, Mickelson, Brady stuff over the weekend? This new norm within golf?
I know, yeah. Actually, Paul McGinley put me in my box last week when he said he didn't really enjoy it. It was too friendly. I watched a bit of it. I didn't watch it all, Damien. I'd be lying if I said I did. But I did watch some of it, and it was, it's a taste of what's going to come, but I can't wait for the real stuff to start on June the 11th in Texas. Okay. I think golf is one of those sports with good enough camera work that you can enjoy more from home and will be okay without a crowd.
I have to apologise to Paul in Galway, because apparently it is absolutely lashing in Galway. So my apologies, and on behalf of Ruby as well, for telling you how nice it is in the east coast of
And you
the
can apologise. I'm not apologising.
Well, sure, you were talking about it. Like, I can,
you know, live west of the Shannon, that's what happens.
Yeah, well, there you go. These are the decisions you make in life. Grant, so we've a busy programme to come. 51552 is our text number. You can tweet us at GameOn2FM. Mentioned we're going to be chatting to Ger Lyons later on in the programme. Guillaume Ballet about La Liga set for a return in the middle of June. I'm going to indulge myself, Ruby, if you don't mind, because it's 15 years ago today since Liverpool won the Champions League final in Istanbul, and Guillaume wrote a fantastic book about that, so prepare yourself. Marie might not be here, but the Liverpool chat is going to continue.
They didn't win it, they robbed it.
Come on. Jeez, like, very harsh. You know, they faced that adversity 3-0 down, and they worked their way back.
I think it's time to take a break.
Yeah, okay. Take a break. Shane Lowry to come. So 51552 at Game On 2FM. And we'll be chatting to the Open champion Shane Lowry in 2 minutes' time. Stay with us.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Well, golf was professional golf, as we know, closed down, of course, early in March, around March 12th. But it is back on June the 11th in Texas. And joining us on the line from Florida is the current Open champion, Shane Lowry. Shane, how are you?
I'm good, lads. How are you doing?
Oh, we're hanging in there. How is life in Florida with Wendy and Iris been?
Yeah, it's not too bad. It's been, I suppose it's been a long 10 or 11 weeks, but I seem to have got through it okay, and we're back playing golf a few weeks now here, so I'm able to get out and practice, which is nice. And I suppose since the PGA Tour came up with a start date, that was the best thing, you know, and it's something sort of to work towards. So that's been nice.
I read somewhere that you, when the lockdown came, you went and bought some gym gear, which is very un-Shane Lowry like. Has the gym gear still been used since you've been back playing golf, or have you just ditched it?
No, it is. Yeah. I've got it in my shed. So I go out there most days anyway. I have a FaceTime session with my trainer Robbie, and I think I'm getting a little bit fitter and stronger. But you know, it was something, I suppose, at the start that just kind of kept me sane, and got me out of the house for a little while, and just got me doing something. And yeah, it's been nice though. It's something that I suppose I've been doing it for a few years, but never really had a big block where I could really focus on it. And I feel like I've focused pretty hard on it over the last while, and yeah, I feel good for it.
You obviously turned pro in 2009 after you won in Baltrae, so that's 11 years on tour. Have you enjoyed the break a little bit, being able to stand back from golf in the whole of your health, or have you found the break frustrating?
Personally, I've found it frustrating. I've missed it. Like, I never thought I'd miss golf the way I did. I missed the competitiveness of it. And I suppose I'm fortunate that hopefully I've got another good few years left in me. But, you know, I certainly did miss the competitive side of it, and going out there and competing week in, week out, and trying to become a better golfer every week. And so I did miss it, and it was quite frustrating. But in another way, it was nice to sort of have a little bit of time off with the family, like sort of 10 weeks at home. The last 10 weeks at home, I've never had that with Ira, so that's been pretty nice. And yeah, it's a bit of both, I suppose.
Shane, just in terms of, you know, the regular season or your regular off season, what would be standard for you to go in terms of weeks with a competitive action?
Well, I suppose you look at, we normally finish like the third week in November every year, and I kind of come back the second or third week in January. So we probably have 6-7 weeks without any competitive golf. I'd normally go 4 weeks without hitting a shot. This time I actually went, I think it was my longest period ever. I think at 6 weeks, 5.5 or 6 weeks without hitting a shot. And that was weird. And it was weird that I had to do it. I had no other choice, you know what I mean, because the golf courses were closed there and I couldn't go practice. And obviously it's my own decision in December to take the time off. So yeah, when you actually have it taken away from you, rather than taken away from yourself, it's a little bit different. So yeah.
Is it important to, or do you have to kind of force yourself not to go back over endless hours of tapes to analyse this and analyse that and everything else? How difficult is it to make the conscious decision to try and have a bit of time to yourself?
Yeah, do you know, it's kind of, mentally it's a difficult place to be, because you kind of, you start to get worried that you're going to lose a little bit of it or a little bit of what you had. And, you know, you sort of need to kind of just keep telling yourself that it's not going to go. And when you do get back playing, look, I was a little bit rusty for a couple of weeks, but I feel like I'm back into the swing of things now, and I feel like practice and my golf is going well. So I feel like I'm kind of back to where I was. But, you know, for a few weeks, and there were certain stages over the whole lockdown that I did find a bit difficult, and mentally a bit difficult, but I'm sure the whole world is like that, you know what I mean? And everyone's had their bad days. So, you know, thankfully I'm back doing what I do, and I'm really looking forward to getting back to some competitive golf in June.
Some of us are still having those bad days, but the golf that you left in March, the game you're going back to now in June, will be a totally different thing. No crowds, no atmosphere. Have you thought about that, or what sort of an impact that might have on your game?
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit strange, but personally, how I feel about it is, I feel like no matter what, you know, crowds or no crowds, I'm just going to be happy to be back playing some competitive golf. So, you know, there's no point complaining about not having crowds. I think it could be that we don't have crowds for a few months, so it's something that you kind of have to get used to. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of other different things are just going to be different than they were, aren't they? So it's just going to take a while to get used to it, and you know, hopefully I get used to it fairly quick and get off to a good start and keep going. But Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see what it's going to be like. I think the first week in Dallas will tell a lot about what's going to happen in the weeks going forward.
And obviously, you said the first week is in Dallas, but your schedule has changed remarkably too. I mean, with so many events cancelled and postponed, do you have an idea what your schedule is going to look like from Dallas onwards?
Yeah, I've got the first 9 weeks we're back. I'm playing seven out of nine. So I play 3 weeks, then have a week off, then two, then a week off, then another two. So it's fairly full on. I think it'll be full on until the end of the year. But you know, we've had a big enough break now that I'll be happy to be back at it. And I suppose obviously the PGA is one of the first big ones. That's the first week in August. So you're kind of gearing up towards that. And then obviously the US Open will be after that. And, you know, hopefully the Masters after that. Obviously, hopefully the Ryder Cup's going to be in between, and hopefully I'll be on that. But we'll have to wait and see what's going to happen there.
Shane, just it might have been simplistic for people to look at the start of 2020 for you and talk about the Ryder Cup being the big thing in September, or obviously the defence of your Open, which isn't going to be the case now. But do you actively sit down with a pen and a piece of paper, or do you talk to Neil Manship, your coach, and redefine what success in 2020 will be now, considering how different the landscape is going to be in terms of that schedule?
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't really thought about it, and I'm not really one for setting big goals or anything. I'm not really one for writing stuff down. You know, my big goal this year, obviously, was to make that Ryder Cup team and try and win the Ryder Cup. And that's still a goal of mine because it's still on as of this time. But obviously, there's other things I'd like to do. You know, there's big tournaments. You know, I'm obviously going to miss out on defending my Open this year. I won't get to do that till 2021, so that's going to be a bit different. So things are just going to be a bit different. I think I'm just going to go back to what I've done over the last few years, and that's kind of living day by day and week by week and just trying to perform as best I can every day. And I think that's kind of the way I've done things, and that's the way I'm going to do things going forward. Anyway.
Will you have Beau on the bag still, or does international travel get affected and impact on all these plans?
Well, Beau's wife is actually having a baby in a few weeks, so I've got a different caddy for the first few weeks, and then Beau will be back out in, I think he's coming back out around late July, August. So, he's not been able to travel just solely because his wife's having a baby in a couple of weeks. Nothing to do with international travel. My caddy, actually, I've got Darren Reynolds, who's a good, another Irishman, on the bag for a couple of weeks.
I know you're back playing golf, Shane, and you have a new caddy along with you. How much golf per day are you playing at the minute? A couple, 4 hours, 5 hours, or even more?
Well, most days I play 18 holes. The weather's actually been really bad here the last few days. It's been storms, so I didn't actually play the last few days. But I play 18 holes most days, and then I do an hour to a couple of hours practice along with that. So now you're playing 18 holes in a bogey, so it's kind of, you're playing in two and a half or 3 hours. So you're out there I'm at the golf course for 5 or 6 hours every day. I was very conscious at the start, say, when golf courses did open up like 4 weeks ago, I was conscious that I didn't want to over-golf myself as well. So I was planning on, from today, like Monday today, I've got 2 weeks left to the first tournament. I was planning on really going back to some proper practice from today. Now the weather is so bad today, I actually can't practice. But from tomorrow onward, I'll be going back to some like proper structured practice, you know, leading into the next run of events.
And obviously, you live in Florida, and the first competition is in Dallas, Texas. What travel arrangements? When will you have to go there, or what way is that set up for you?
It's just normal. I'd be flying on the Monday, so travel. There's no real travel restrictions here in the US. It's kind of, it's open as normal. Obviously, I can imagine it's not as busy as it normally is. But, there's no quarantine or anything when you're traveling in between states. It's just kind of, you know, the same as normal. So I'll be just traveling on Mondays and, you know, every week.
Shane, the exhibition matches of late, and I know obviously there's such a hunger for live sport to return to television worldwide, but particularly in the States where it's such a saturation at the weekend. How much of a benefit has it been to golf, do you think, to get back out there first and the novelty of the exhibitions that we've seen in recent weeks, which seem to have been very, very well received?
Yeah, it's look, it was all right. I thought the match yesterday, to be honest, was very good with Tiger and Phil and Peyton Manning and Tom Brady. I thought the amateurs hitting the bad shots actually added to it. And, you know, it was nice to watch and it seemed like good fun or whatever. I think I've said all along, I think this is a good opportunity for golf to be one of the first sports to get back on TV. And, you know, maybe people are so starved and deprived of live sport that it might get a few more people into the game. And look, hopefully we'll be out there with no crowds and trying to make things as exciting as possible. But, you know, I'm not sure how exciting you can actually make it. You just have to try and do our best. But like I said, I think it is a good opportunity for golf to get back out there and get on the TV and, you know, get a few more people watching it.
Mm. And is it an active thing in the States to try and sell golf now as a means of, you know, outdoor activity, the space, something that could well become a very safe pastime compared to, say, basketball or those indoor sports?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't really know. I just know, look, it is one of the sports that's a lot easier to play. You know, obviously golf has just opened back up back home as well in the last week or so, and I certainly have a lot of friends that are back out playing golf. Even guys that didn't play that much before this are going out and playing a little bit more now, just to kind of, it's nice to get out of the house, get a bit of fresh air and go and do something. And golf is a great way of doing that. So I'm not sure if it is trying to sell it like that, but it certainly should be anyway.
And Shane, I know you've given us your schedule for the PGA Tour for the first 9 weeks, but if the European Tour gets up and running, would you have any ambitions or any targets maybe to come and play on this side of the Atlantic?
You know, like, I don't think so. I think the way it is, especially with the quarantine on both sides, I don't think that's actually physically possible for me. But the only tournament I would contemplate going back playing is if there was an Irish Open put back on the schedule or something like that. But as of now, I don't really have any, you know, I haven't seen the schedule from the European Tour, so I can't really tell, but I probably don't. I'd probably be mostly in America until, you know, definitely the rest of the year.
Well, I hope you have plenty of success in America for the rest of the year, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of Irish eyes watching you. Thanks a million for taking our call, and go and practice in the rain. It mightn't do you any harm.
Thanks, lads.
Cheers. Good
luck. I'll talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks, Shane.
A million.
Cheers.
All right.
Tweet at GameOn2FM. Or you can text the programme as well. 51552 is our text number. Text in, we live in a secondary road. Our closest area is a park, like a park, is a GAA pitch, which is 3 kilometres away. Should our kids play on a bendy road? No, I clearly wasn't suggesting that your kids should go out and play on a bendy road. I mentioned earlier, and we're going to chat about it in a couple of minutes' time, 15 years since Liverpool won the Champions League, which I'm going to just keep reminding you about, Ruby.
You're going to talk about it, Damien. I'm most certainly not going to.
May 25th will also always be about 11 men born within 30 miles of Glasgow, went to Lisbon, destroyed Inter Milan. And I've got an email in from Killian McCarthy, who wants me to ask you about this night 25 years ago. He reckons Willie Mullins beat you in a bumper in Tipperary. You finished second. And he's wondering if you could have ever had an idea then what direction your life and your career in racing would have taken.
I most certainly couldn't. That was the second ride I ever had in my life. Willie Mullins beat me on step on air. I rode a horse called Wild Irish 25 years ago. Jeepers.
How good are, like, you know, it often surprises people. You talk to people about what we as punters or people in the media think are really iconic memories in their life, and they can't remember half of it. Like, you know, you talk to Brian O'Driscoll about matches and the details just slip away. How good are you at remembering the details of races like that? Is it encyclopedic?
I can remember a lot of the early stuff and most of the late stuff, but definitely plenty in the middle is a bit blurry. I was watching races the other day. I was actually watching Nolan winning in Cheltenham, and I didn't realise that I was so far back. I had so many horses in front of me coming down the hill. So you remember some things, you don't remember others, but sure. I think we're all that way, Damien.
That's it. We're going to chat soccer next. English Premier League clubs to vote this week at their next shareholder meeting about the prospect of significantly increasing their collective training and certainly looking to reintroduce some element of contact training. We're well aware the Bundesliga is back up and running. Serie A has suspended until at least the 14th of June. The league in France is cancelled. The league in Holland is abandoned. And Spain over the weekend announced that they are going to target a return for the weekend of June 12th. And most clubs return to some level of training over the weekend. So joined to chat about this and an awful lot more by Guillaume Balague. Guillaume, how are you?
Good afternoon. Yeah, fine. Happy that little by little we're going back to some kind of normality.
There you go. You get out to see a couple of matches again. It's looking at the stats and the COVID-19 facts and figures around Spain. Obviously, cases declining, the virus in many ways regionalised. And this is a very, very significant step, not just for sport in the country, but for the economy in the country as well, that there is this big attempt now to get La Liga completed.
That's right. It is a financial reason why La Liga is going back. And for instance, from the third tier down is all been cancelled. That's quite obvious. It happens in all the big countries. But they've also, through Javier Tebas, the head of La Liga, they've been trying to go one step ahead of everybody else, partly to just give hope to everybody that there is something out there that resembles normality, and partly because the government has also pushed them to come back early, as you know, it's an opportunity to entertain us while we still got most of the country. It's in, well, half and half really. Phase two, which opens, you know, the shops are open, restaurants, etc. Phase one is where the other half of the country is with the still limitations. But meanwhile, it's good to see that the training has been, they've added five more players to training, so it's groups of 14, and from Monday will be the whole group training together. And as you mentioned, the idea is that to play the first game, perhaps it hasn't been confirmed by the government, on the 11th, Thursday the 11th, and with a Sevilla Betis, Sevilla derby.
Just on the finances of it, and we've been chatting about this over the course of the programme, about one of our rugby teams over here cancelling their season ticket renewals for next season. Such will be the impact of social distancing on their ability to hold a capacity crowd. But the figures are pretty startling. Estimated €973 million lost to the economy if the league is abandoned, €341 million if it's played behind closed doors. And even the amount of the TV rights deals that the clubs would have to pay back would be very significant, particularly in a league where you ignore Real, Barca and Atletico, and you have issues about the sustainability of the financial side of clubs further down La Liga.
Yes, I mean, we are seeing a golden age of finances for La Liga because they cut the money that they've been owing the taxman for many years. They actually have managed to raise their own money as well, and they are in a good position. But quite clearly, if it means no more football, for instance, more than returning money to the television, in the case of Spain, it was not getting 25% of the money that has to be paid at the end of May or beginning of June. That was the agreement. Why is the rush to do it to come back on the 11th or 12th? Because the televisions were also saying, if we leave it a little bit later, we won't be able to have games every day as we're planning, which means that you will then have to reduce the money that we'll have to reduce the money we have to pay you back. Yeah, there was a financial implication, but those figures are huge figures. The money that La Liga produces is 1.3% of the income in the whole country. So it's a big percentage for one industry that has felt all along they could actually get to play games. And as La Liga insists, and Javier Tebas insists, those players that will be on the pitch will be the safest in the whole of the country because of the tests they're going through, the filters that they have to go through, and you know the fact that they don't want anything but healthy players on the pitch. So there is no fear of anything. There was a little bit of discussion about if it would be a good idea or not to be, like they did in Germany, a whole week in a hotel before the beginning of the restart. But I think the fact that there's hardly been any players with COVID at this stage means that they know what they have to do. most of them, because I don't know if you saw the picture from Sevilla players and the girlfriends meeting for a bit of a drinky pool like, 3 days ago. They had to apologise for. They kind of forgot their rules there. But apart from them, everybody's behaved very well.
Kian, if it does return on June the 12th, it will be match day 28 of 38. So there's 11 days as such left to play. How quickly will La Liga be able to play the end of the season off?
The idea is to play every 3 days. So every team will have to play 3 days and finish about the 26th of July, which is what the UEFA wants, so everybody can focus then in the Champions League, returning about the 7th of August. And yes, every 3 days means obviously you have to put the calendar together. Perhaps after the first week there will be a week break, but after that, yes, be two games per week per team. But for television, it's a dream because it will be games every single day. The only doubt will be maybe Mondays because the federation haven't accepted. It's up to them. Haven't accepted Monday as a day for playing. But if they convince the federation, then it means there'll be football every day. So I'm preparing for it. I work now for La Liga TV, which is a channel thing you can get in Ireland, and that means afternoon shows with whatever's happened so far, plus games in the evening, every day from the 11th until the 26th of July.
11th of July. I'll be brutally honest with you now, but I haven't much interest in watching Eibar playing Espanyol, but are there any big clashes coming on? Have Barcelona to play Real or Real to play Atletico? Is there any big derby or big matchups left in the season?
From the first weekend, if memory doesn't fail me, is an Athletic Club de Bilbao, which will probably be the Friday, and then the idea is to have Real Madrid on the Saturday and Barcelona on the Sunday. So the big games from that point of view, they've gone. But remember, it's a competition that's everything to play for, really. Barcelona and Madrid separated by 2 points. Madrid lost against Betis the last weekend, the last game that they played. Everybody seems to be beating everybody at the moment. Nobody is running with the league. And then there is a bunch of 5 or 6 teams fighting for the other 2 positions for the Champions League. And at the bottom, poor Espanyol is right at the bottom with not much hope of saving themselves. But there is, again, 4 or 5 teams just fighting for relegation. So don't give up. There is still lots of entertainment.
Just on Barcelona, that 2-point advantage over Real. Real, I think, have the advantage if it came to the head-to-head. But when football was still being played, it was largely being overshadowed by the civil war behind the scenes at Barcelona. Now, that has died off a little bit in recent weeks, certainly in terms of its place in the public consciousness. How happy is life at the Nou Camp, or could that explode again between now and season's end?
It's tense. It's tense because the focus, as you will say, has gone from something that hasn't been resolved, a couple of accusations on the behaviour of the directors, which is still being investigated internally. But he's moved from there to actually, how do we get 70 million euros that we need to get before the end of the financial year? And how can we do that without making the team too weak? And how can we still bring new players? And it's a little bit of a magic they're going to have to do here. They've got agreements with Pjanic of Juventus, midfielder, and Lautaro Martinez of Inter, the forward. Personal agreements with both of them, but now they have to convince Inter and Juventus that, look, this guy, this Arta, he's so good. He can go to Juventus. Don't you want him? Juventus has said yes, but now Arta doesn't want to go. Rakitic, Semedo, who do you want? Everybody in Barcelona is for sale, apart from Ter Stegen, Messi and De Jong. And that's what they are putting all the focus on. It's a lot of fun to actually read the Catalan media right now because every day Barcelona signs a massive player. It won't be like that. And a lot of it will have to come from imagination and those swaps that I'm talking about.
Kian, Damien wants to be indulged.
Well, I was
15
years ago today. I've been joking. I've been kind of winding Ruby up over the course. Now, I've been reminded that the Lisbon Lions winning the old European Cup on this day is a far better story than reliving Liverpool's, as Ruby said earlier, robbing the Champions League back in 2005. You quite literally wrote the book on that season, a season on the brink, which if Liverpool fans want to re-indulge, they can enjoy. If we look at this objectively, how significant a final in the history of the Champions League or the European Cup was played this night 15 years ago?
If you didn't have that night, if you didn't have a game in which everybody, as everybody remembers, 3-0 down for Liverpool, they turn it around, penalties, etc., it would be harder to say that everything is possible in football. But after that, you have to say it, because literally anything you can imagine can happen in a football game. And I know that through the book and obviously the stories that you've seen today, for instance, 15 years after what happened, people will try to make or understand really what happened through talking to the people that were there and analysing the tactics. But a lot of it is completely impossible to explain. And that, again, is the magic of football. I spoke to Rafa today, and this is like his, almost like his second birthday. He gets more messages today, Happy Istanbul Day, than hope for his own birthday. So it is something that has changed the life of many. And as you know, as we all remember in here, it was a unique occasion. And I think most of us football fans remember where we were.
Okay. Guillaume, thanks very much for joining us. It's Guillaume Balagay. Joining us there, Ruby, I had like I was saying to like people who have heard me on the radio over the years will know I'm a Liverpool fan and everything else. So Bruce Springsteen did a solo acoustic gig yesterday, 15 years ago, and I gave away my tickets in order to go to Istanbul and support Liverpool instead. And to this day, my wife still reminds me how much she enjoyed Bruce Springsteen and texting me at halftime in the match to say, "Jesus, I think you missed that great Bruce Springsteen gig last night in order to go see Liverpool get hammered." And I don't have one single photograph to remember Istanbul by. My camera got broken in Istanbul airport coming home.
So, well, no, there's moments in history you remember where you were.
Yeah,
I can. And even though I'm not a Liverpool fan, I can remember where I watched that game and where I was. As Guillaume says, when you saw that game, anything is possible. I couldn't believe what was happening. I couldn't believe Liverpool were getting back to 3-3 and then end up winning on penalties. I remember for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, we got back, like, I won't go on about it, I'll finish on this. We got back to the hotel at, like, you know, the early hours in the morning, and there were fellas sitting at the bar in the hotel in floods of tears, and you kind of presume it's, like, because...
Yeah, they were Man United fans.
No, they all left at half-time. Genuinely left at half-time. So if you're in, if you've ever been to the Atatürk Stadium outside Istanbul, it's kind of built lopsided, and you can see from the top tier of one of the stands, you can see out over the terrace behind the goal. And there were just floods of people walking across what was a building site and left. So there's a man somewhere in Donegal who has loads of pictures of me and his camera, because myself and my dad hung around with this fella and his son over the course of the week. So if you know a fella who, I think he owned a quarry, and he's got loads of pictures from Istanbul in 2005, I might be somewhere in the back of one of them.
Text them on to 51552, please. It's time to take a break.
Game on, racing.
Welcome back to Game On. Well, in 2 weeks' time, exactly 2 weeks' time, on June the 8th, horse racing will have returned at Nace. And joining me on the line is leading trainer Ger Lyons. Ger, you must be looking forward to it.
Can't wait, Ruby. Yeah, it's been forever since we were at a race course, so horses are raring to go, fit and ready, and can't wait, and hopefully we get there.
Well, straight in, I mean, at the end of the first week is the 2,000 guineas at the Curra, and you have one of the leading fancies in Siskin, a horse I'm a massive fan of. How has he wintered, and even Springer?
Yeah, he did well, Ruby. All through spring, probably, if you put the gun to my head, I would have said we were probably going to be an optimum trip of 7 furlongs, say. And then he's just thrived in the last month, and his work has been backed up every week. We kept going. We, you know, I took the view that early doors, that we just keep the horses going with a view that we'll get back. And then we got the news that we weren't back till the 29th. So that was the only sort of negative we had in the whole thing. But his work has thrived right through, and I would say now I'd rather go a mile than I would drop him back in trip at this stage, the way he's working.
He had a wonderful two-year-old career. I mean, he won his first 4 starts, but then had a bit of a blip in Newmarket in the stalls. Mm-hmm. Have you done much practicing with him since, or have you just put that behind you?
No, we've done plenty. What I tended to do in the lockdown was, rather than gallop the brains out of them every Wednesday and Saturday, I sort of turned a Wednesday like into a school in the morning, like you'd have down on Willie's, and we put everything through the stalls. And so he's done plenty, and he's great. We put a hood on him, and he seems to be at ease with a hood on him, so that's what we do. But it was just one of those things, Ruby, because it's not in his nature. And as you know, in racing, You know, you haven't won your race till you cross the line, and you take nothing for granted with a racehorse. Anything can go wrong at the last minute, and it was just one of those things. It was totally out of character.
In an ideal world, Jar, a 2,000 guineas winner would be going to Royal Ascot for the St. James's Palace. It's probably coming up a bit quick for your horse, I would have thought, after the Curragh, is it?
Yeah, that's the negative. Listen, it's a high-class problem, but where do you go with him after? Like, if he's lucky enough to be a contender in the Irish Guineas, in other words, if he's thereabouts at the finishing post, your obvious next target is the St. James's Palace. And as we speak, there's no racing in Britain. But they're all planning to make entries tomorrow for next Monday. They were betting maybe odds on that they're going to race next Monday. So let's assume that they are. They're kicking into Royal Ascot, staying on the same date. So they're racing in Royal Ascot 2 weeks after their start. I can't see it being very... Yeah, I can't see being clever running in a Guineas and running back within a week in a James's Palace. It's a problem, but we're going to have to mount nearer the time, and we'll get the Irish Guineas out of the way first. But it is, where do you go? What do you do? But we'll probably take a view that Goodwood will be his next port of call, I would say, you know. But it'd be disappointing with its circumstances, you know.
You mentioned Goodwood as the next port of call. As it stands at the minute, if your horse goes to the UK, anybody that comes back will have to quarantine for 14 days. Would that be a consideration with your jockey, Colin Keane?
Absolutely, yeah. It's unfortunate that it's the law of the land. I'd like to think something will have happened by then, because things are moving at a pace at the moment. But I've already discussed it with the boys, and I've got a top-class rider in Gary Carroll here as well. And while I don't think it would be fair to, you know, it'll be Colin's call, he'll get first shout, and if Colin wanted to stay here, there's a lot of big races here at home through that time, then Gary would go over and ride him, you know. But I'm well covered on the jockey front, Ruby.
The other thing that we've all been enjoying, but it is a concern for racing, even flat racing, is the very good weather, Jar. Do you think race courses will be able to produce nice, safe ground during this dry period, having had no target to keep tracks maintained for?
I think they should be able to, Ruby, because they've had enough time. Like, we've known now that we're coming back on the 8 for a while, and it's a question of them just getting out, and that's their job, is to maintain the track, promote growth, and I think they've enough time to produce racetracks in good order. Shane's been walking nice there continuously there for a while, and he tells me that's in superb condition. So there's no reason they can't, Ruby. And then, you know, our weather, when it does start raining, it doesn't stop. So I'd be surprised if... I don't think it's an excuse with tracks, because they've been given enough notice, I think. Would you not agree?
I do, but I just think quick ground can be hard to try and make easy. I mean, if you start pouring it on, it only rolls off the top. But yeah. I wonder, I don't know what you think yourself, but it's great to have racing back, but how long do you think racing will be sustainable behind closed doors with no crowds, no gate receipts?
Yeah, listen, the crowds are important. Ironically, the flat doesn't suffer from crowd. You know, the crowds like you do and the jumps, okay, the big meetings and that will suffer. But, I mean, it is all about the customer and the crowd. But ultimately, we need to get back racing. If we don't get back racing, the whole industry suffers. Like, basically, racing is the shop window for the rest of the industry. And, you know, we have the classics. And without the classics being run, you've no stud book. Without the stud book, you've no sales. So there's a whole pyramid of events that would happen negatively if racing didn't go ahead. So it's not ideal. And I think it's for the long term until we find a vaccine. I don't believe that anybody can just switch on a switch and say everybody go back as normal until a vaccine is found. That's the way I think about the whole thing. So we're lucky in the sense that we have racing covered on TV. I believe that the networks should probably show free to air or do some sort of a deal, because it's a great opportunity to sell the game to new people. The racing, when we go back initially, is going to be the hottest racing you've seen for quite a while. I mean, the maidens will be phenomenal. All the lads are ready to get their horses out. They'll be, you know, it'll be imperative to get their classic horses out, get the first run into them for the Oaks and the Derby for races like that. Okay, we're going to struggle. We're all going to go to the Guineas as our first run. But the racing for the first 3 weeks, I'd say, is going to be as hot and as competitive as you're going to see anywhere. And it's a great opportunity for us to sell the sport to new people.
So racing obviously took a bashing after Cheltenham, and the public perception in some quarters hasn't been great. Do you believe that quality of racing early when the racing comes back can win people back to racing?
I do. I think we should park the negatives. And I was one of the ones when I was asked, where should the Guineas go when we start back? I said the Guineas should be on the Monday and Tuesday. We should start with the Guineas. Two reasons. Go big was one of them. And secondly, it gives us more time between, if you're lucky enough to win a Guineas, to go for Ascot. But I do think that we should park all the negatives, be proud of what we, our sport, our industry, of what we're promoting and what we're producing, and hold our heads up high and just and show the world what we have. It's a top class industry. It employs loads of people. We shouldn't be apologising for going back to work. We should be proud. Like this race, and as you know, it lends itself to what we're doing, which is, you know, out social distancing. We're a young workforce. We're out in the open air. I'll stand corrected, but I don't think there's been any positives. We haven't stopped working in the lockdown. We all carried on as normal, and I don't think there's been any positives in the industry. So that's a plus. And I just think it's one of those industries, a little bit like what Shane was saying about golf. It's one of those industries that can survive, do its job in a lockdown or behind closed doors.
Well, I most certainly hope it can. Thanks a million, Jar, and the best of luck with Siskin.
Cheers, Ruby. Nice meeting you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Ruby, just before we finish up, it probably is fair to say racing is the industry upon which the most pressure or most focus will come in terms of how it reintegrates.
It will, but I think it can handle it. I mean, they did have 10 meetings before the lockdown, which were staged behind closed door. The IHRB, the HRI. Like, Damon, you want to see the paraphernalia that came out that everybody has to read and adhere to. There's 77 pages in the booklet of the rules for behind closed door racing.
It's been a great pleasure. I'll chat to you again tomorrow.
And mine.
Thank you, Daniel. Daniel was our VCO tonight. Ronan Lawler produced from Ruby.
Game on.
Until tomorrow, we wish you well.
Game on 2FM.